Good morning. I would just mention generally that in these cases, there are sealed documents. So we would urge counsel to avoid reference to them unless some other agreement has been reached with the parties. And if the court's questions veer in that area, to just stop us. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Rogers, and may it please the court. The immediate suspension order in this case should be set aside because it is based on a significant change in agency policy that is invalid, both because it represents an unreasonable interpretation of the agency's own rules and because it was unaccompanied by notice and comment rulemaking or even the reasoned explanation that the Supreme Court has held is required for an agency policy change.
Do you have to win on the merits of this case to win on the ISO? All we have before us today is the ISO, right?
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. No.
You seem to be plunging right into, aren't you biting off more than you have to chew?
Well, Your Honor, if there's an easier route for us to prevail, we certainly wouldn't want to discourage the court from taking it. What I would say is the ISO is grounded on a finding of the violation of legal duties, one of which we think is absolutely invalid, but the duty to halt, to investigate and halt shipment pending investigation. And we think that that is a sufficient basis for this court to set aside the ISO, the immediate suspension order, which has been in effect for some 7 months, and in effect puts a padlock around a major distribution center for all Schedule II drugs. Now, this was an extraordinary administrative action taken without prior notice or an opportunity.
Yeah, and what's the normal basis for taking it without prior notice? It's not the validity of the regulation, it's the imminence of harm to the public, isn't it?
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. Now, we think that
when you said a while ago if there's an easier way to win, wouldn't that be the normal way one would approach an ISO argument?
Well, and Your Honor, certainly one of our positions is that there is no imminent danger set forth in the ISO. I think in order to understand the agency's thinking of what was an imminent danger, it did base that on a finding of the statutory violations, and I think that that was necessary under 824D, the provision of the statute that gives the administrator this extraordinary power. Now, the court could disagree with that and still...
That might be something they could find after notice and hearing, but isn't your best argument on the ISO that there's a due process problem, that you're entitled to a notice and hearing unless the imminence element is met?
That's absolutely right.
You
and our central...
You seem to be coming down here asking us to invalidate the whole proceeding against you.
Well, no, Your Honor, because the revocation proceeding would presumably could go forward, although we would there's no reason why this court couldn't recognize, and we think it should recognize, that this legal duty that has been asserted, that is a principal basis for the ISO, is invalid. Now, Your Honor is quite right that you could find other grounds for why the imminency finding is not sufficient.
Why should the court go all the way to that issue if you could prevail on the imminence?
If we could prevail on the other ground, Your Honor, the court would not need to. What I would respectfully submit is this is an invalid legal duty. It's clear that it's invalid on the record before you, and for that reason alone, the court should say that this duty doesn't exist. There's no reason to have Walgreens or the DEA go through this extensive proceeding on the basis of a violation that is improper, and this court, I think, is well positioned to say that. You know, having said that, we wouldn't discourage this court from invalidating the ISO on any ground. That's the basis we're here today, the ISO.
Well, I understood your brief as saying that the question of notice and comment was an antecedent question we had to get to because it was the due diligence requirement was one of the two elements DEA relied on for the imminent danger finding.
That's right, Your Honor. We do think it's one of the two. Now, I think.
So we could say, I suppose we could say, well, even assuming the due diligence requirement is valid, it together with the other finding that is a failure report isn't sufficient for imminent danger finding. We could do that, right?
The court could do that, Your Honor.
But
I think that the.
Yeah, I see. Right.
But I think that the court is still presented before it with an ISO which is grounded in principal part on the violation of a legal duty that unquestionably represents a significant change in the law. There are many cases in which the court may have to speculate on that, but here it has the sworn testimony of a senior DEA official that this was, quote, a significant change in DEA policy.
Who was that official, by the way?
Your Honor, it was Kyle Wright. He was an officer in the Office of Diversion Control. He was the agent that the DEA put forward in this other case to testify about its regulatory policies.
He was like the number two supervisor because he reported to somebody named Marks, I think.
He was within there are several leading officials within the Office of Diversion Control. He ultimately reported to the deputy director of the DEA. And he was the person that the DEA put forth in that case to testify about it, and the district court in that case made findings that this was a significant change and about his testimony that were not challenged on appeal. In fact, the government abandoned appeal in that case. So certainly we think that, and with respect to this issue of the change, again, to be clear, we have two arguments on this. One is we don't think that this interpretation is reasonable at all under the agency's regulations, because the agency's regulations specifically establish a reporting requirement, but not this additional investigate and halt shipment requirement. And we think that follows from the analysis that this court set forth in the Ethelcorp case. But the second argument is even if they could convince the court that this was somehow a plausible interpretation, an agency can't undertake this sort of significant policy change without going through notice and comment rulemaking as required by cases like paralyzed veterans, the Alaska professional hunters case. So that in itself is an independent defect. And it gets even worse for the agency because under the Supreme Court's recent decision in FCC versus Fox Television, we know that at the bare minimum, the agency has to both recognize a change and provide reasoned explanation for that change. The agency has never attempted that here. Its position before this court is
that principle would only come into play if notice and comment weren't required, right?
Yes.
Okay. So again, let's go back to the antecedent issue here, or use that word again. So the way to think about this, I take it, is first, see if you think I have this right. The first question is, was it a change that required notice and comment, right? Second, even if it didn't, was it an unexplained change, right?
Well,
are those separate?
I think they are separate grounds. Either would be sufficient to say that the manner they went about this was invalid under the APA. But we think that there's a threshold issue, Your Honor, which is that there's no room for this interpretation at all under their own regulations, given the way that the regulations are set up, which is to say in 1301.71a, that the administrator shall use these specific requirements to determine whether or not they're...
But isn't that the notice and comment point? In other words, they could add this due diligence. They would just have to do it through notice and comment rulemaking, right?
No, Your Honor, it's not. It's the argument that the regulations preclude this altogether, and you can sort of stop there without getting...
Well, can't they change their regulation?
They can, Your Honor. They can, going through notice and comment.
Right.
And it goes to their point that they can do this without notice and comment. And our point on that is they can't because it's precluded by the regulations, the text of their own regulations. It's an unreasonable interpretation.
But they can change their regulations.
But they can change it through notice and comment.
Through notice and comment. So they could, right, they could, if they had authority under the statute to add this due diligence requirement, they could do it through notice and comment.
Well, ultimately, they could, Your Honor. Obviously, they have not undertaken that. And what they have here is an administrative order grounded on the violation of a duty that is quite simply unlawful.
And from your perspective, the reason for us to address that question first, notice and comment, as opposed to the merits of the imminent danger finding, I think, is that you have the merits hearing ahead of you, right?
No, Your Honor, we think it's a sufficient ground to say that this order was contrary to law. Now, once you got into the merits, if by that you refer to the findings, and we think that there are several flaws with the order on its own, it's based on a broad assumption that all orders which may have originated from pain clinics were illegitimate. It's based, if you look at the order very carefully, all of all of the allegations of wrongdoing take place in 2010 and 2011, yet this order is issued in September of 2012. And then if you look at paragraphs 20 and 21 of the order, you find that the only basis that they actually identify in 2012 for believing that there's a harm is that Walgreens is the biggest distributor in the state and that the average sales from Walgreens stores are slightly higher than the average sales, national sales for pharmacies, which of course include many mom-and-pop pharmacies. So that those figures are absolutely meaningless in establishing an imminent danger in September 2012. The other thing that they pointed to is the failure to comply with the reporting requirement. Now, we do recognize that that is a requirement in the regulations. That's not a sufficient basis to uphold this order because the order was based on so many other invalid reasons. Under Chenery, this court has to send it back and have the agency consider it. But even with respect to the reporting violations, I want this court to understand that the reason why Walgreens stopped making those reports in 2012 is because it's changed its reporting system so that orders were automatically cut off at the pharmacy level before they even got to the distribution level. During the same period, moreover, Walgreens was making the so-called ARCOS reports to the DEA on a monthly basis. That's acknowledged of all its inventory and all its orders during this period. And during this period, it's undisputed, I think, and that ISO recognized Walgreens had made substantial reductions in the amount of orders going to these pharmacies, some 75%. And if you look at the chart on page 23 of our brief, it shows the dramatic drop-off in the distribution. So we think it's simply unfounded, even if this court goes to the merits, that there was an imminent danger in September in 2012 when this order was issued. And for any of those bases, this extraordinary administrative act should be set aside. If I could reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Samantha Heifetz for the Department of Justice and the Drug Enforcement Administration. Plaintiff's case challenges, concedes to begin with, the reporting failures that the DEA administrator...
Would you mind starting with the notice and comment?
Sure.
Questions and focus on that. And specifically, Walgreens' argument that that this new requirement, that the due diligence requirement is new and required notice and comment rulemaking, that it's not covered by existing regulation, not included in it.
Right. So to take the first point, the suggestion that this is a new requirement, the conduct at issue in the case, we're talking about distributing practices beginning really in 2009 through 2012. Now, back in 2006, there's no dispute that letters were issued by DEA, guidance letters, that went out to all the distributors, Walgreens included, explaining that DEA was in these letters reiterating responsibilities incumbent upon distributors. The first of these letters was September 2006, okay? Telling distributors, saying, we think you're already well aware, that's a quote from the letter, of these responsibilities, but we are reiterating them.
The question is whether those notices, notice and comment rulemaking was required to authorize those notices.
Well, notice and comment rulemaking would only be required if we were marking an amendment, a change from a pre-existing regulation.
Well, the argument is that that's exactly what happened here, that this regulation says the agency shall consider, and it lists a bunch of things, and it doesn't list anything else, and unlike other regulations, it doesn't say it shall consider these and such other factors.
Right. Your Honor, it certainly says that the DEA shall consider a variety of factors, and those factors are things like the size of the vault in which substances are held, et cetera. Those factors must be considered. There's no dispute about that. What the regulation does not say, Your Honor. What the regulation does not say is that that is in any sense an exclusive list. It simply says that those things shall be considered.
So
DEA never interpreted. Yes, Your Honor. DEA never interpreted that regulation to be exclusive. There is no point in history, not even in the Kyle Wright testimony cited by opposing counsel, where DEA has ever suggested that that list was exclusive.
But
now,
in the same regulation, in exactly the same regulation, subsection 34, it says in determining whether an importer, et cetera, against diversion, the administrator shall consider, among other factors, and then it lists them. So in the same regulation, you have the agency saying, for one standard, you shall consider, in this case, specific things, and in this other one, specific items, among other factors.
That's right. There
Isn't
are
that
other...
Isn't that a pretty clear indication that, at least for with respect
No, Your Honor, because here what we're dealing with is not a statute that lists a bunch of broad... A regulation that lists a broad set of factors to be considered. We're talking about a regulation that identifies some very specific physical security controls that need to be looked at. To step back for a moment, what we're talking about here on DEA's part is not an expectation of some... obscure responsibility on the part of the distributors. We are talking about distributors who have in front of them a suspicious order, an order they themselves have recognized as suspicious. And the question is, what does the distributor need to then do? Should they simply distribute that?
Regulations require them to do.
Well, we have a statute here. We have a statute. Sorry?
You're not responding to my question. I would agree with you about the word shall if that's all we had. If it said you shall do this, that doesn't mean you can't do other things. But the question I'm asking you is that in the same regulation, another provision says consider among other factors. And the question I was asking you is, doesn't the inclusion of among other factors in the same regulation for another provision suggest that among other factors was not included in this one? That's my only question.
Well, my point, Your Honor, is that those other regulations are in many cases looking at then broad factors. And what we're talking about here, what DEA is instructed to look at, are not broad factors, but very specific requirements that would not be in any sense apparent from the face of the statute, such as the number of inches thick a container for controlled substances must be to pass muster. Whereas what we're talking about here in this case is the very self-evident expectation that if you have in front of you an order that sends up red flags for diversion controls and you have a statutory responsibility as a registered distributor to maintain effective controls against diversion, and as DEA had explained in the 2007 Southwood decision, you have a responsibility to ensure that you're not willy-nilly sending out orders without regard to the red flags you yourself have observed. Well then, you know, this is something that's flowing directly from the statute and the
statute, but the question here is whether the regulation has been written in a way that confines the agency to the specified standards. In other words, you may well be right that the regulation can be lawfully amended to include this, but the argument that the petitioner is making is that the way the regulation is written is that it confines the agency to the specified factors.
And that has never been DEA's interpretation of its own regulation. And they cite no evidence to the contrary. The only times that DEA has spoken, it has loud and clear explained that it did expect. Now, prior to 2006, we simply have no comment from DEA. There's no established agency regulation, no formal statement. But in 2006, we have the first guidance letter putting in writing what DEA had thought was evident, reiterating these responsibilities and talking about this expectation. Then in 2007, though, we have the Southwood decision, then we have the novelty decision, both formal adjudications, which both expressly recognize this responsibility. The novelty decision, DEA says, a distributor has an affirmative duty to forego a transaction if upon investigation it's unable to determine that the proposed transaction is for legitimate purposes. The Southwood decision, we of course discuss at length in our brief. Later that year, you have another letter going out reiterating these responsibilities, emphasizing in that one the need for timely reporting of suspicious orders, something else that Walgreens here, the Jupiter Center, failed to do. Now, you know, the only evidence that they point to suggest that this is a change of policy is this testimony during a civil asset forfeiture proceeding, a bankruptcy case, where the question presented to the court was not one about interpreting the CSA, but about looking at whether a distributor should have known certain things. And Kyle Wright's testimony speaks to what had, before 2006, in his opinion, been the enforcement policies and practices of DEA, but it was not an official.
If you sit down, I think you've been over this part. I would like to know what your best argument is for the truncating of the procedure, that is to say, the ISO, the imminent danger.
Yes, yes.
You can't just go out and act without due process.
That's right. This court has concluded that when proceedings are done in accord with the statutory provision at 824D for immediate suspension orders, there is not a due process problem.
What your basis is for imminent danger in this case?
Absolutely.
Not what this court has held as a general proposition.
Absolutely. Your Honor, in this case, we have the Jupiter Center, the largest distributor of oxycodone in Florida.
I know they've done bad things in the past, but now there are two stages to litigation, or I know you allege they've done bad things. Normally, you would have to prove that after notice and hearing.
Well, we have.
If you can show an imminent danger, then you can proceed with an ISO. Now, as I read the charts and the numbers in the record, the massive distribution had dropped off dramatically. The best response I got from the government was, well, they only did that after they were charged. I don't know why that would matter in determining imminent danger. That might go to the ultimate resolution, but so far as determining imminent danger, I don't see what the imminent danger is that you're relying on for the use of the ISO without Matthews v. Eldridge process.
As the ISO acknowledges, there was a drop-off in numbers among, you know, for example, the top eight stores where Walgreens cut off completely.
That goes to the reason not to use the ISO. There was a drop-off.
Well,
now give me the reason why you do use the ISO, how you do justify.
So what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the reason for the ISO, to step back, the numbers here were a huge red flag for DEA and, frankly, for Walgreens as well. The record.
Changing the subject again.
No, sorry,
Huge red flag. All right, this goes to merits. That goes to merits. But normally you would have to establish those merits with Matthews v. Eldridge process.
So I just wanted to lay out the chronology, but
we know
to move forward, Your Honor. After the notation of this huge red flag of the numbers began the DEA investigation. Okay, so now DEA issues the warrants, goes in, interviews staff, subpoenas documents. The findings of that investigation.
ISO.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. It's that, yes.
Counsel, whoa. The fact that the agency issues a subpoena can't possibly justify an ISO.
Oh, no, Your Honor. I apologize. That's not.
The agency conducts an investigation. Will you please quit interrupting us? The fact that the agency conducts an investigation can't possibly justify an ISO. What I want to know is what is the imminent danger that gets you past the requirement for due process?
You have a facility here that DEA found had none of the essential protective systems to control against diversion. The statute places a great emphasis, for good reason, on the need to prevent diversion. You didn't have here staff that were trained in how to identify orders. You had a Schedule II manager at the Jupiter facility who said it wasn't her job to do any kind of due diligence when it came to suspicious orders. You have a center that abdicates its responsibility to report suspicious orders, which DEA has repeatedly noted is crucial to preventing harm to the public. So Your Honor, I do apologize for my meandering narrative, but what I was trying to highlight for you is that the numbers are only a small part of the story. They're the trigger here. They raise significant concerns because they are so high and they remain high, and though they come down for certain stores where Jupiter imposes this blunt approach of simply cutting off Schedule 2 operations, that's not the same as remedying the systematic shortcomings that were so worrisome to DEA. And those systematic shortcomings are in part undisputed here. There's no dispute about the shortcomings with regard to reporting or detecting suspicious orders. And then there's no dispute.
This is a distribution center, right? Not a pharmacy. Correct?
It's a distributor. Yeah. It's a distributor, yeah.
So I hear what you're saying in response to Judge Sentell's question, namely that the problem here is the failure to perform due diligence and to do the reporting, right? What's the difference between that and the ultimate decision about suspension? In other words, is what the agency is saying is that any failure to report and any due diligence defects are, in addition to being a grounds for revocation, a grounds for a imminent danger finding? Is that your point?
No, Your Honor.
Well, what is the difference?
Our point here.
I don't see in this any difference. I see a potentially solid basis for an ultimate revocation. But what I don't see in the record, and the only thing you have, the agency has, are the due diligence and reporting failures for a distribution center. Why does that? What in that adds to the imminent danger finding? That's what I don't understand.
If you had these failures, these same failures occurring at a tiny distributor with a very small distribution, a mom and pop distributor of sorts, perhaps that wouldn't rise to the level of imminent danger. But here,
by a large distributor, you get an ISO.
No, I'm saying that where you have a distributor who's distributing the kinds of quantities of dangerous Schedule 2 through 5 controlled substances, but specifically oxycodone, that Jupiter was distributing, you really do have a very serious concern for public safety. I mean, put this in perspective.
They suspended the 8 stores with the most serious problems. And they say, and you don't disagree in your, they say in the blue brief that DEA has no evidence about diversion at any other store. And in your brief, you didn't challenge that.
So I'm not sure. When you talk about evidence of diversion, the DEA did not have the resources.
Isn't that what an imminent danger is?
Well, DEA did not do the kind of in-depth investigation at all 800 and nearly 850 Florida pharmacies that the Jupiter Center distributes to. Where DEA focused its investigation, it found tremendous indicators of diversion. I mean, we're talking about
And the company suspended those stores.
Well, they suspended them in May 2012 after the administrative inspection warrants were served.
Why should that make a difference? I mean, well, the question is there or is there not an imminent danger?
One of the concern here about imminent danger is do we have
the imminent danger more than
do we have a distributor? The question here for DEA was, are we dealing with a distributor who can be trusted as a registrant to protect the public interest, or do we think that their continued registration is causing imminent danger? And the conclusion was this was a threat to the public safety, an imminent threat, because this was a distributor that was not taking any of its responsibilities to protect the public safety seriously. And the timeline confirms that.
In a due process hearing, and you seem to be establishing a line that says any time we charge a major violation, we get an ISO. And I don't see any other line you're
doing. No, Your Honor, there are many instances in which we don't charge ISOs in conjunction with orders to show cause. And some of the Walgreens pharmacies are examples of that. But here, just to put these things in perspective, right, this is a company that asserted in letters to DEA back in May 2012, saying, look, we're vertically integrated. We may not have, you know, whether or not they've essentially asserted whether or not things happened at the distributor, there was due diligence adequately occurring at the pharmacies or perhaps at headquarters. But then when we turn to look at the things that were happening at the pharmacies, we find that due diligence wasn't happening. Instead, what we find are some of the examples cited in the ISO. You have pharmacies with, you know, arrests going on in the parking lot. You have people being seeing drugs passed inside the pharmacy, people being arrested on the premises, the police chief of Oviedo sending letters to everyone at Walgreens up the chain to the CEO and chairman begging for help. And what is the Jupiter Center doing? Continuing to distribute large amounts, ever-increasing amounts. The point of these narratives is that we do have large numbers going out to lots of stores outside of the top six, even in 2012, when they claim that their numbers have come down so much. If you look, for example, at the top 25,
You concede that their numbers have come down.
Well, we concede that they cut off.
You concede their numbers have come down considerably, right or wrong?
It's really, we do acknowledge that they were able to bring down the numbers by taking certain measures, but it's important to recognize the huge increase that we saw at one point, 20% of that increase, 19%, was a result of the top six stores. So what do? They cut off those stores completely. That doesn't tell us anything about whether or not they have the kind of controls needed to prevent diversion going to all the other stores where we still see distributions happening in 2012 to those stores that are more than a standard deviation away from the mean. You've got a national average.
Can I just be clear? The controls you're talking about is the due diligence and stop shipments?
The due diligence and the stop shipments certainly speak to the important controls, but suspicious order reporting is another terrifically important part of this that they don't dispute they weren't doing, because that's what facilitates DEA field officials being able to carry out the kinds of investigations necessary to stop diversion. This is a closed regulatory scheme in which DEA allows people to participate, registers them to make these distributions with the understanding that everyone, as explained in the letters in the Southwind decision and novelty, that everyone's going to contribute to monitoring the system. And here what we had was a distribution center that, because this is an integrated company, tried to say, well, look to the pharmacies to do it or look to headquarters to do it. And then when DEA looks to those places and finds that the controls aren't in place, they turn around and say, well, that's a problem at the pharmacy. That's not a problem with us. I mean, they're trying to hide the ball here, I think, in a critical way.
Anything further? New argument?
new arguments?
I mean, in terms of, we're sort of repeating ourselves here.
Well,
and you're way over time.
I have one question. Is that okay?
All right.
It's a procedural. It's a new question.
Good.
New subject. I'm already getting into the next case, right? So if we agree with petitioner that the adoption of the due diligence requirement was defective, either because it needed notice and comment or because it was an unacknowledged change, just assume that we think that. Do you agree then that this has to be vacated because there's no indication in the agency's decision that the other basis for the imminent danger finding, namely the failure report, was an independent one? Do you agree with that? That's what they say in their reply.
Your Honor, they do assert that. No, Your Honor, the suspicious order, the failures there, they try in their brief to suggest that this is a mere technicality
aside.
I understand, but I think those are connected.
Just focus on my specific question. In novelty, where we did sustain it because it was other, the agency had said that the other factor was, quote, reason alone for the order. Whereas here, as I read the order, it looks to me like the two factors are a combined analysis. I didn't see any indication, and you can correct me about this if you want, that the agency was telling us that they're independent bases for an imminent danger finding.
The agency certainly, the ISO certainly explains why the suspicious order requirement is a tremendously important one. And so though there is not a line in the ISO that expressly states that that alone would be significant enough to justify an imminent danger, there's not that text. What there is an explanation of the fact that the worry here is that we have a distributor.
I agree with all that, but I hear you conceding.
And that worry.
I hear you conceding that they are not, there's nothing in this that says these are two independent bases, right?
There is not that line, but I think it's a fair reading of the decision to understand and worth understanding that the suspicious order requirement speaks to the broader concern, and therefore.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. All right. Counsel for appellant here.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a few brief points. On the last point, Judge Tatel, not only does the order not provide anything like for this reason alone, as was true in novelty, it says at the very end on page JA28, in view of the foregoing. And that underscores that this order was based on everything, the violation of the completely new and invalid investigate and halt shipment duty is all throughout this, paragraphs 6, 10, 11, 12, 22, and 24 all rely on that explicitly. So this order would have to be set aside if this court agrees with us that that was an invalid change in interpretation.
So from your point of view, just so I'm clear, the change or the new requirements that you say you required notice and comment, that alone would be grounds for setting aside the ISO, since your client was not required to do those things under law.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Under Chenery and other decisions of this court, the court would have to send the order back.
And so we need not venture into an examination of what must be shown for imminent danger. I just want to be clear about
that. Well, that's right, Your Honor. The court would be saying that you cannot base an ISO on an alleged violation of an invalid legal duty. With respect to what I think Your Honors have referred to the merits, though, I would just close by saying that the critical paragraphs in the ISO are paragraphs 20 and 21. And in those paragraphs, the administrator first recognizes that Walgreens had made substantial reductions in the distributions to the key stores that the DEA itself had focused on. It's never provided evidence of any diversion with respect to other stores. That reduction is shown markedly on the chart that appears on page 196 of the joint appendix in this brief. And then it goes on the next paragraph, 21, to try to explain the harm that's existing today. And all it points to is the fact that Walgreens is the biggest distributor in the state and has distribution above the national average. It's not a violation of the Controlled Substances Act to be big, and it's not enough to base this kind of extraordinary action on a finding of past harm. Congress required a finding of imminent danger, and this order is completely lacking in establishing that necessary predicate. If there are no further questions, we would urge this court to act quickly. Thank you.
Thank you.